Now, we saw last week that in verses 27 to 31 of Luke chapter 6, Jesus describes the kind of love which should characterize his disciples. And in a word, it's love for enemies. And we saw then that Jesus begins in these verses by elaborating on the content of this love. It involves action. Do good to those who hate you. It involves goodwill. Bless those who curse you. And it involves prayer. Pray for those who ill-treat you. And we saw that Jesus then goes on to mention a couple of concrete situations in which this kind of love might be exercised. The first situation is when people are taking advantage of your lowly status. To strike someone across the cheek, remember, in this culture was to basically treat them as a slave. And Jesus is saying then that when people are unfairly treating you as a bit of a slave, show love to them. Turn the other cheek. Show yourself even more willing to serve them, in other words, than they are to make you serve them. And then the other situation is when people are taking advantage of your generosity. And as a man then who in the past has borrowed your cloak and he's never given it back to you, and now he wants to borrow your tunic. Well, Jesus says, show love to that man. Let him have the tunic as well, even though you'll probably never see that again either. And then we saw that Jesus concludes then this description of his disciples' love with this memorable principle: do to others as you would have them do to you. Just then as Haman in the book of Esther chapter 6 had to compile that mental list of all the things that he would like to have done to him, and then he had to go and do all those things to someone else, to Mordecai the Jew. So we should be constantly compiling mental lists of all the things that we would like to have done to us, and then going out and doing all those things, not simply to one man like Mordecai the Jew, but to everyone with whom we ever come into contact. And so that then is this radical, enemy-embracing love which Jesus describes in verses 27 to 31. And basically in this morning's passage, verses 37 to 49, he continues in the same theme. Only here, he doesn't really add anything to his description of loving your enemies. Rather, he emphasizes here the vital role which loving your enemies performs within Christian discipleship. He impresses upon us here that this isn't some optional extra for super disciples. This is the bread and butter. This is the very ABC of Christian discipleship. This is a most basic constituent of following Jesus Christ. This is absolutely indispensable, loving your enemies. And so we must ask the question then, how is that the case? Why is loving your enemies so absolutely indispensable? Well, I want you to notice five things with me this morning. First of all, its importance for your relationship with God. Its importance for your relationship with God, verses 37 and 38. Now we all know, don't we, both from the Bible and from our experience, that as Christians, we have to be constantly, daily indeed, going to God and making petitions like these. Lord, do not judge and condemn me for the way in which I have treated you. Lord, forgive me for all the wrongs that I have committed against you. Lord, despite all that I have done to you, continue to give generously all your mercies, all your blessings, all your good gifts to me. Because we're so sinful, we're such flawed men and women, as Christians, we're constantly, aren't we, having to go to God with petitions like those upon our lips. But you see, if while praying so frequently that God won't judge and condemn us, we are busy judging and condemning other people. We're busy judging and condemning that colleague at work who has been spreading the malicious lies about us around the office, to use last week's illustration. Whenever we speak to him, in other words, whenever we look at him, our minds are immediately filled with blame and with criticism and with disapproval and with censure. Well, if that's the case, is God really going to take that prayer of ours seriously? If while praying so frequently for God to forgive us for our sins, we are going about showing absolutely no forgiveness whatsoever to other people, to that colleague at work who has wronged us. Again, is God really going to take that prayer of ours seriously? If while praying so frequently that God will continue to give to us of all his good things, of all his good gifts, we aren't giving away so much as a smile to that man at work who has offended us. Again, is God really going to take that prayer of ours seriously? Well, Jesus' answer is quite emphatic in these verses. Do not judge. In other words, do not judge other people, and you will not be judged by God. Do not condemn other people, and you will not be condemned by God. Forgive other people, and you will be forgiven by God. Give to other people, and it will be given by God to you. You see, Jesus is saying that you can't separate off into two entirely different compartments your relationship with God on the one hand and your relationship with your enemies on the other hand. You can't relate to your enemies in bitterness and hostility and expect God to keep relating to you in grace and in mercy. It's simply not going to happen. Sooner or later, your lack of forgiveness and generosity towards others is going to interrupt the flow of God's forgiveness and generosity toward you. It doesn't matter how diligently and passionately and articulately you might be praying. What you are doing in refusing to open your arms to that person who has wronged and injured you will inevitably disrupt your relationship with God. I wonder, are we taking that seriously this morning? Are our daily prayers for mercy meaningful because arising out of a context in which mercy has been shown to others? Or are our daily prayers for mercy ridiculous sounding things, inherently ludicrous, because arising out of a context in which mercy is not being shown to others? It's a very solemn thing, isn't it, that the only prayer for forgiveness which our Lord taught us to pray was this one: forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. No other prayer for forgiveness have we ever been taught. That one, the one that doesn't stop at forgive us our trespasses, but goes on to say as we forgive those who trespass against us. Loving your enemies, showing kindness and grace and welcome and warmth to those who have injured you, perhaps profoundly and repeatedly, it is vitally important to the health and the maintenance of your relationship with God. So that's the first thing then. Secondly, its importance when choosing your leaders. Its importance when choosing your leaders. Verses 39 and 40. He also told them this parable: can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A student is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. Now, the religious culture in Jesus' day was a distinctly clerical one. You didn't in those days pick up your views about God or your views about man or your views about the law or indeed your views about anything really through thinking through them yourselves or from discussing them with other people or from searching for answers on the internet. In those days, you picked up your views about God and about man and about the law and everything else from rabbis and from teachers and from leaders. You relied heavily upon those kind of men. They gave you your theology. They were the men who shaped decisively your worldview. It was, as I say, a very clerical culture in which you attached yourself to a certain leader and you would be that person's disciple. And it's into this context then that Jesus is speaking in these verses, and he's warning his hearers here that you've got to be very careful what kind of teachers, what kind of leaders you listen to. You've got to be very discerning in which rabbis you attach yourselves to. You've got to be very wise in choosing your leaders. Why? Because he says some of these men, some of these rabbis, some of these leaders, some of these teachers are blind. And it's a well-known fact that a student never rises above his teacher. And so if your teacher is blind, then you yourself are bound ultimately to share in his blindness. Well, what's Jesus talking about? What is this blindness that he's speaking of in these teachers, in these leaders that he's referring to? Well, I think that, again, in the context, it must concern this whole matter of loving your enemies. And Jesus is saying then that there are some leaders out there, there are some teachers out there, there are some rabbis out there, and they certainly don't practice and nor do they even teach loving your enemies. They have no place for doing good to those who hate you. They have no emphasis upon blessing those who curse you. They have no interest in praying for those who ill-treat you. It just doesn't feature in their theology, in their worldview. And Jesus is saying that that is an intolerable omission in their lives and in their ministries. That, Jesus is saying, is a blindness which you must be very, very wary of. Keep away from those kind of teachers. Keep away from those leaders and rabbis in whom there is this striking omission, no reference to loving your enemies. Now, of course, you and I are living and operating in a very different religious culture. And I suppose the age in which we live is a distinctly anti-clerical age. And so now there's a great emphasis upon thinking through things for ourselves, upon searching for answers, whether it's in books or on the internet or wherever it might be. But still, it's the case, isn't it, that in our circles at least, we listen to preachers. And perhaps we look up to certain figures in our churches who we regard as mentors, who we can learn from and who can disciple us and can cultivate spiritual growth within us. And that, of course, is a very good and a healthy thing. But Jesus is saying to us then, I think, that we too have to be careful about who we listen to. We have to be careful about who we follow, about who we expose ourselves to. Whose teaching we expose ourselves to, whose theology we expose ourselves to, whose worldviews we expose ourselves to, even within the Christian church. Because still today, there can be this blindness. Now, Jesus isn't saying here that we should be nitpicking and hair-splitting and fault-finding in our mentality, and we should never listen to a preacher and never look up to anyone as a kind of mentor unless they dot absolutely every single I and cross every single T. He's not saying that. But what Jesus is saying is this, that a preacher or a mentor or a church leader of any description who doesn't teach and practice loving enemies. It doesn't matter how orthodox and brilliant that person's preaching might be. It doesn't matter how impeccable that person's credentials might be. It doesn't matter how respectable that person's associations might be. That person is blind. That is a blind leader. And you must not touch that leader with a barge pole. They might be able to explain predestination and the Trinity and justification by faith and the atonement perfectly. They might be able to wax lyrical in their sermons for hours on end without tiring their hearers. But if loving one's enemies doesn't figure in their teaching and in their lives, then they're blind and they'll lead you into a pit, Jesus is saying. And we must take that seriously. And this should be then the question on our lips all the time. The question for every vacancy committee in a local church. The question for every ministerial training committee. The question for every conference organization committee. The question for anyone, whoever in any capacity, has the role of assessing a man's suitability to teach. This must be the question on their lips. Not simply, is this man a good preacher? Is this man's doctrines okay? But does this man teach and practice love for enemies? It's vitally important, Jesus is saying, not only in our relationship with God, but when choosing our leaders. Thirdly, its importance when correcting a brother. Its importance when correcting a brother. Verses 41 and 42. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when you yourself fail to see the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. When I was at the Banner Ministers Conference in April, one of the speakers was talking at one point about the role of humour in preaching. And he came out with the memorable line that some preachers won't give you an ounce of humour, but they'll happily give you a ton of dullness. And I'm sure there's much truth in that. Well, Jesus certainly wasn't dull in his teaching, but he did at times give some humour. And I think we have an example of it here in this passage, this ridiculous picture that he portrays of this man then who is so fussy about a speck of sawdust in somebody else's eye, just this tiny little speck that you can hardly see, that isn't even bothering the person, this tiny little speck of dust. And yet all along, he's got this huge plank in his own eye. The word that Jesus uses here, it's a word that was used for the kind of the main beam in the construction of a house. We're talking about a kind of railway sleeper here, a massive plank of wood sticking out of his eye. And here he is so bothered about the little speck of dust in the other person's eye. I'm sure that it would have brought a smile to the lips of his hearers. And Jesus' point then, of course, is that if you're about to criticize somebody else and yet you're in a worse situation than them, then you have absolutely no right to do so. You need to sort yourself out before you turn to that other person. And we tend to apply it fairly generally like that. But I think, again, in the context, Jesus is probably talking primarily about this issue of loving your enemies. Doubtless he has the Pharisees in his mind still. Here are these Pharisees, and they were constantly going around pointing out specks in people's eyes. They were constantly going about pointing out people's failure to observe the Sabbath properly and people's inadequacy in fasting properly and their inadequacy in this area and their inadequacy in that area. And yet, so many of these Pharisees were themselves such merciless men in their hearts. We know that, we've seen that already. Haven't we, in earlier on in chapter 6, in verse 11, the way in which they're already planning to go and kill Jesus himself. That's how they treated their enemies, planning to kill him Or we have another example of their mercilessness in Mark chapter 7, where Jesus talks about how unloving they are toward their parents, these Pharisees. You can look it up for yourself sometime, Mark 7 verses 9 to 13. And if they're like that toward their parents, how must they have been toward their enemies? And so here they were then. And they were always pointing out these little things in other people's lives. And yet, all along, Jesus is saying, they had this plank in their own eye of failing to love their enemies properly. And Jesus is saying they have no right, therefore. They have no right to criticize others. They have no right to point out the faults in other people. Those faults might be real, but those faults pale into utter insignificance compared to their fault of failing to show love and kindness and acceptance to those who have wronged them. But although Jesus has the Pharisees in mind, he's talking, of course, to his own disciples here. He's talking to us as well, 2,000 years later, as his disciples. And he knows that the Pharisaical mentality is a very infectious one. And it's one that we can easily take on board. And we too can very easily go about with this plank, this railway sleeper in our eyes, of failing to love that colleague at work who has wronged us. Those next door neighbours we mentioned last week who have refused us permission to build the extension just out of sheer spite. Those people who have, just for no good reason at all, just gone against us and done us harm. And yet we're failing to love them and accept them and forgive them. And Jesus is saying that is a plank which far outgrows, which far exceeds the little specks that so often we're pointing out in others' lives. And so we must ask the question, next time we're going to step in and point something out in someone else's life. Next time we hear a sermon here and we say, oh, I must get the tape for so-and-so. Next time we're tempted to do that, we must ask ourselves first, hang on, am I entitled to do that? Am I entitled to go and point something out in someone else's life? Do I have the right to do that? Or is it in fact the case that they have only a speck in their eye, I have a plank in mine, because I'm failing to love my enemies? Let's be constantly asking that question. It's not, of course, wrong in and of itself to point out other people's faults. There's a biblical place for that, for getting alongside a brother. Galatians chapter 6 talks about it, doesn't it? Getting alongside a brother and helping him when he has strayed into some sin. In and of itself, it's not wrong to correct somebody. But we must be constantly asking ourselves first, am I entitled to do this? Or am I just a hypocrite? Because he's got a speck in his eye, I've got a plank in mine. So it's vitally important when correcting a brother. Fourthly, its importance for authentication purposes. Its importance for authentication purposes, which sounds perhaps a bit grand, but look at verses 43 to 45. And this business of the trees, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars, and so on. And so Jesus is simply reminding us here of a very obvious and well-known principle that the fruit tells us everything. That's the case, isn't it? In the natural realm, the fruit tells us everything. So if then you're out one day in the countryside and you come across this apple tree and it's absolutely laden with beautiful, delicious, juicy apples. It's just full of them. Apples everywhere. They're falling off in the wind and they're just beautiful fruit and you can't resist taking one and eating it. Well, in that case, you don't need to kind of scratch your head and think, well, I wonder if this tree is a healthy tree or an unhealthy tree. You don't need to kind of take a cutting of it and send it off to some laboratory to work out what exactly the health of this tree is. It's obvious. It's a good tree. If, on the other hand, you're out there in the countryside, you come across a tree and it's looking pretty pathetic, there's just the odd kind of apple here and there which you can hardly recognize as an apple, they're just so withered and so rotten, and you would never in a million years want to put one in your mouth, then again, you don't have to say to yourself, well, I wonder whether this is a healthy tree or not. Again, you don't have to kind of subject it to some scientific inquiry. It's obvious. It's an unhealthy tree. Or to use the other illustration that Jesus uses here, if you're out there for a walk and you come across a tree and there's figs growing on it, well, you don't need to go back home and search for hours on the internet to find out what kind of tree it was. What kind of tree could possibly produce figs? Well, obviously, it was a fig tree. Or there again, if you're out in the countryside and you come across a thorn bush, then you don't get angry with that thorn bush because there's no juicy grapes growing on it. It's a thorn bush. And so you don't expect it to grow juicy grapes. And so it's just an obvious principle in the natural realm. The fruit tells us everything. If you can see the fruit, then you don't need to go into all kinds of other inquiries and channels of exploration. The fruit tells you enough. And Jesus is saying then that it's the same in the spiritual realm. The fruit tells us everything about a person. The fruit of their lives tells us everything about their spiritual condition. And so he says in verse 45, the good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. And of course he's speaking one level generally here, that it's true across the board, that a person who is in good spiritual health, a person who is truly a Christian, truly a disciple of Jesus, will generally produce good fruit. But I think he's, again, in the context, speaking specifically about this matter of loving your enemies. And he's saying then that the person who is truly the disciple, the person who is truly united to me, the person who is truly my follower, will indeed produce this fruit of loving their enemies. And the person who isn't, conversely, will not produce that fruit. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he then, in verse 45, concludes by saying, for out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks. And he seems to be linking very much then loving for enemies with speech. So often it's our speech, isn't it, that betrays a lack of love for our enemies, that betrays that bitterness, that unacceptance of people. Or conversely, it's our speech, it's our words, it's our tongue that demonstrates a forgiving, kind, accepting attitude toward our enemies. And so Jesus is saying then, that if there's a person and he is generally bitter and harsh and unloving toward those who have wronged him, then you can be pretty sure, Jesus is saying, that that person isn't a disciple of mine. The fruit tells you everything. You don't need to be troubled by the fact that that person claims at some stage to have had some experience of Jesus, that person claims at some stage to have been baptized, that person claims to have had this experience and that experience. If that person generally, and we're talking, of course, about the general trend of their lives, not a one-off moment, because we're all sinners. But if the general trend of that person's life is one of lovelessness toward enemies, then regardless of other considerations, then you can be pretty sure that person isn't a disciple of mine. And yes, as I say, there may be other factors that they would like you to look at. The fact I've had this experience, and I've been a church member, I've been baptized, I've had this and this. And Jesus is saying, no, the fruit tells you everything. The lovelessness toward enemies tells you enough. And then, conversely, if there's someone, and again, the general trend of their lives is loving their enemies, is a forgiving spirit, a generous spirit, a large-hearted spirit, then you can be pretty sure that that person is a disciple of Jesus Christ. And you don't need to be troubled by the fact that perhaps they have strange views about this doctrine, strange views about that doctrine. They go to a church that you're not entirely happy with. They don't dot your I's, they don't cross your T's. If that person is showing love to their enemies as the general trend of their lives, then you can be pretty sure that person is a disciple of Jesus. The fruit tells you everything. And so, this business then of loving your enemies, it's vitally important, not only for your relationship with God, not only when choosing your leaders, not only when correcting a brother, but for authenticating those who truly are disciples of Jesus Christ. What about you this morning? Is the fruit there? Is it obvious because of the way you've treated that colleague at work since he wronged you? Is it obvious that you are indeed a disciple of Jesus? No more inquiry needs to be made. It's unmistakable from the way that you've reacted. Or is in fact the contrary the case? And the evidence seems to show that you're not a disciple at all. Fifthly, finally, its importance for the day of judgment. And this really just follows on from what we've already been saying. Verses 46 to 49. Because it seems to me that that's what this flood that's mentioned in verse 48, or torrent that's mentioned there, and in the next verse, it seems to me that ultimately is what it's talking about. It's not talking simply about the storms of life, as some people sometimes perhaps read it. I think it's talking ultimately about nothing less than the day of judgment itself. And it's saying then that those who will survive on that day of judgment, those who will survive when the torrent, the flood of God's judgment comes upon their lives, will be those who have a deep foundation. And what is that foundation? It is hearing my words, verse 47, and putting them into practice. It's those who have this deep foundation of having heard Jesus and put his words into practice. It is they who will survive on the day that the flood of God's judgment comes down upon them. Now, again, of course, Jesus is speaking across the board. It's those who have heard Jesus and put his words into practice generally, all his words. But again, in the context, he must, I think, be speaking most of all about this matter of loving your enemies. And he's saying something very, very solemn then. He's saying that this is the most important thing about loving your enemies. This, more than anything, is why it's so crucial and so indispensable. Because those who, when it comes to that last day and they're standing before Jesus Christ, those who haven't loved their enemies, and they haven't therefore built on that good, solid, deep foundation, they won't survive. They won't last when the judgment comes. And that's euphemistic language. For, in other words, then being cast into that place of everlasting torment, the weeping, the wailing, the gnashing of teeth. Well, you say, we're saved, aren't we, through faith in Jesus Christ? Of course we are. Well, what about those then who are there on that last day and they're standing before Jesus Christ and they have believed in him? They have exercised faith, but they haven't loved their enemies. They've been malicious, horrible, spiteful people. What about those in that situation? Well, the answer is, of course, that there won't be anybody in that situation. Because all those who have truly believed in Jesus Christ and so been saved by faith alone will have accompanied that faith, that saving faith, with a love and a generosity and a kindness toward their enemies. We're talking here, as I said at the start then, not about something that's an optional extra, a luxury for some Christians, the kind of Christians who make it into the biographies, the kind of Christians whose names are celebrated throughout Christendom. No, this is the mark of all Jesus' followers. Followers of Jesus, by definition, will be those who, when wronged, when injured, when treated badly by other people. Don't respond in the same way. Don't respond to evil with evil, but overcome evil with good. And who show something of the attitude of their Savior himself, who, as we said last week, even while hanging on his cross, prayed, "Father, forgive them. Forgive these murderers. Forgive these crucifiers. Forgive these men who are putting me to death, because they do not know what they are doing." This morning, are we showing that Christ-likeness? Amen.